Hello, and welcome to today's News in Perspective. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Brian Kim, reading opinions from syndicated columnists, editorials from national newspapers, and views from experts in their fields. Our first article today is from The Nation. This was posted on April 19th, 2024, and it's called, 25 Years After the Columbine Massacre, Is There Any Hope to End America's Epidemic of Gun Violence? By Peter Dreer. Peter Dreer teaches politics at Occidental College and is author of several books, including Baseball Rebels, The Players, People, and Social Movements That Shook Up the Game and Changed America, published in April of 2022. 25 years ago tomorrow, on April 20th, 1999, two 12th grade students at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, armed with semi-automatic rifles and pistols, murdered 12 students and one teacher, and injured another 21 people. The Columbine Massacre triggered a national debate on gun violence. But the epidemic of gun violence has continued. In fact, it has escalated. Public opinion remains strongly in favor of stricter laws, but politicians, cowed by the National Rifle Association, have failed to do their job of protecting Americans from this plague. There had been other mass shootings, including school shootings, before, but Columbine was a turning point. Thanks in part to Michael Moore's powerful, eponymous 2002 film, the very word Columbine has been seared into our collective memory, helping to awaken many Americans to the harsh reality of gun violence. But it represented a turning point in another way, too. The number of mass shootings has increased since then, and the debate over how to address the problem has become even more politically polarized. Since Columbine, the nation has witnessed 476 school shootings. Last year's 82 school shootings marked the highest annual total during a quarter century that also included massacres at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012, where 26 people, including 20 children, were killed, the 2018 rampage at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, that took the lives of 17 people, and the murders of 21 people, 19 students and 2 teachers, at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, in 2022. All these incidents have engraved into our national consciousness. So have other massacres, including shootings at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, 12 dead, a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 dead, a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, 26 dead, and a synagogue in Pittsburgh, 11 dead, an army base in Fort Hood, Texas, 13 dead, and a Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., 12 dead, an immigration center in Birmingham, New York, 13 dead, a bowling alley and bar in Lewiston, Maine, 18 dead, a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, 49 dead, and a music festival in Las Vegas, 58 dead, a shopping mall in Allen, Texas, 8 dead, and a bank in Louisville, Kentucky, 5 dead, supermarkets in Buffalo, New York, 10 dead, in Boulder, Colorado, 10 dead, a dance studio in Monterey Park, California, 10 dead, and a social services agency in San Bernardino, California, 14 dead, Walmart stores in Chesapeake, Virginia, 16 dead, and El Paso, Texas, 23 dead, on the campuses at Virginia Tech, 32 killed, Umpqua Community College in Oregon, 9 killed, Michigan State University, 3 killed, and Northern Illinois University, 5 killed, and during a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, 7 dead, 48 wounded. During the past decade, between 2014 and 2023, there were at least 5,758 mass shooting incidents in the United States, defined by the Gun Violence Archive as indiscriminate rampages in public spaces that kill or wound 4 or more people. In 2023 alone, there were 656 mass shooting incidents, resulting in 709 deaths and 2,676 injuries. There were another 98 mass shootings during the first 3 months of this year, leading to 141 people dead and 357 wounded. But this is only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to gun violence. Mass shootings get the most media attention, but they represent a narrow sliver of America's gun problem, which includes domestic violence, gang killings, accidental shootings, and suicides. Last year witnessed 42,940 deaths by gun violence, This includes 18,850 homicides, murders, and accidents, or 52 a day, and 24,090 gun-related suicides, or 66 per day. Among the victims were over 1,600 children and teenagers under 18. Guns are the leading cause of death for American children and teens. We've almost come to accept such violence as normal. At least a generation and a half of Americans, certainly anyone who is under 35, have lived their entire lives traumatized by regular occurrences of mass murder. The victims include not only the dead and injured in their families and friends, but also the rest of society. The collateral damage is the prospect of an entire generation living with the fear that anyone can be the target of random violence. We have normalized massive child trauma because we have allowed racists and psychopaths to easily obtain guns, including military-style assault weapons. Even though a significant majority of Americans support tougher gun laws, their voices have been drowned out by the National Rifle Association. Americans own about 393 million firearms. That's 46% of all civilian-owned firearms in the world, even though the United States accounts for just 4.2% of the world's population. 44% of U.S. adults, roughly 83 million Americans, say they have a gun in their home or on their property. Adults with a gun in their household have an average of 4.9 guns, but some homes have an arsenal of weapons. A 2017 report revealed that about half of all privately owned firearms in the U.S. are owned by 3% of American adults. But the danger isn't simply the number of guns, it's the type of guns we allow people to legally purchase. Other countries permit their citizens to owning hunting rifles. Many Americans, however, believe it is their right to own an assault weapon. In recent years, some states have strengthened their gun control laws, but others have weakened them. While states with stronger gun laws have less gun violence, state laws aren't sufficient. Most gun-related deaths are committed by people who purchase their weapons legally, primarily in states with lax gun laws. Many guns are also purchased by straw buyers, who then sell them to people who are prohibited from buying them. For example, 12% of guns recovered from crimes in New York, a state with strong gun laws and among those with the fewest licensed dealers per capita, were purchased in Georgia, which has some of the weakest gun laws in the nation. In 2021, over 10,300 guns, 28 per day, were either lost by or stolen from gun shops. Quite a few end up in illegal markets where they are trafficked and used in crimes, according to Everytown Gun Safety, another gun control advocacy group. It is tempting to say that all these gun deaths reflect something basically wrong with American culture or the nation's very soul, but the majority of Americans favor stricter gun control laws. Majorities of Americans have consistently favored stricter gun laws, with notable upticks after well-publicized shootings such as in Parkland in 2018 and in Uvalde in 2022, when the number favoring tougher laws spiked to 66%. The Gallup poll's most recent study in October found that 56% of U.S. adults, including 88% of Democrats, 56% of independents, and 26% of Republicans, say gun laws should be stricter, while 31% believe they should be kept as they are now, and 12% favor less strict gun laws. A significant majority of Americans, 61%, say it is too easy to legally obtain a gun in this country, according to a Pew Research Center survey conducted in 2023. Even 38% of gun owners say it is too easy to legally obtain a gun. The same poll discovered that 60% of Americans, including 91% of Democrats and 60% of Republicans, oppose allowing people to carry concealed firearms without a permit, which is currently legal in 26 states. 64% of Americans, including 85% of Democrats and 42% of Republicans, favor banning assault-style weapons. Roughly the same number support outlawing the sale of high-capacity ammunition magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Almost all police chiefs favor requiring criminal background checks for all firearm sales. After each mass killing, people come together to express their sympathy for the victims, anger at the senseless violence, and determination to bring about change. Each time, their hopes are raised, and then dashed when Congress fails to act, cowed by the NRA. But the NRA's power is on the wane. Soon after the Uvalde, Texas shootings in 2022, President Joe Biden proposed the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which requires background checks on gun purchases for young adults, increased mental health funding, and expanded prohibitions on gun ownership for people convicted of domestic violence. It also created incentives for states to pass red flag laws, which prevent individuals who show signs of being a threat to themselves or others from purchasing or possessing any kind of firearm. Even Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, who for years received 100% ratings from the NRA, criticized the organization for failing to support the bill. "We worked with the NRA, listened to their concerns," Cornyn said, "but in the end, I think they simply have a membership and a business model that will not allow them to support any legislation." Despite the NRA's opposition, Congress passed the bill in June of 2022. It was the first major piece of federal gun reform since the 1993 Brady Bill, which mandated federal background checks on firearms purchases, but was overturned by the Supreme Court 5 years later because it required state and local officials to conduct the background checks. The Safer Communities Act was an important step forward, but it fell far short of what gun control advocates have called for, including universal background checks, a ban on the sale of assault weapons, and longer waiting periods for gun purchases. To the NRA, weak gun laws have nothing to do with the epidemic of gun-related killings. It has long had two knee-jerk responses to the epidemic of gun violence. The first is that the Second Amendment gives all Americans the right to possess guns of all kinds, not just hunting rifles, but machine guns and semi-automatic rifles. Efforts to restrict gun sales and ownership is, according to the NRA, an assault on our constitutional freedoms. The second is the cliche that guns don't kill people, people kill people. The NRA claims to speak for America's gun owners, but less than 5% of gun owners are NRA members, and the number is shrinking. Under the leadership of Wayne LaPierre, who became executive vice president in 1991, the NRA forged ties with ultra-right and racist organizations. Under LaPierre, the organization has been plagued with mismanagement and corruption scandals, including growing scrutiny of its finances, political influence peddling, and allegations of ties to Russian operatives. The organization faced allegations of exorbitant spending by top executives. LaPierre used his NRA expense account to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on clothes, luxury vacations to Italy, the Bahamas, Palm Beach, Florida, and other expensive destinations. The Washington Post also revealed a LaPierre scheme to have the NRA purchase a $6 million mansion in Dallas for him. In 2020, New York Attorney General Letitia James brought a lawsuit alleging that LaPierre and other NRA officials broke nonprofit laws and used millions of NRA funds on personal expenses. Until this year, LaPierre had survived efforts to oust him. But in January of this year, a few days before James's lawsuit went to trial, LaPierre announced that he was resigning. These leadership scandals have led to declining membership and financial problems. NRA membership dropped from about 5.2 million in 2018 to about 4.2 million today, and is likely to continue to fall. The NRA's total revenue fell too, from $352 million in 2018 to $211 million in 2022. It had to get a $28 million line of credit against its lavish Virginia headquarters. In January of 2021, the NRA filed for bankruptcy protection in Texas, as part of an effort to avoid a probe by the New York Attorney General's office, but a federal bankruptcy judge dismissed that case. These scandals have undercut the NRA's political influence. In 2016, the NRA spent over $50 million to help elect Trump and other candidates, almost all of them Republicans. 4 years later, faced with major financial woes, the NRA spent less than half that amount. During the 2022 midterms, the organization could only muster about $14 million in political spending. In the past, many candidates for political office, mostly Republicans, but also some Democrats, flocked to the NRA's annual convention. That's no longer true. The current financial situation is untenable and is akin to bailing a leaking boat with a spoon, Rocky Marshall, a former NRA board member, told The Reload, a website that monitors the NRA. The NRA's extreme views are increasingly out of touch with most Americans, most gun owners, and even many of its own members. Gun owners who don't belong to the NRA are more supportive than NRA members of banning assault-style weapons and high-capacity magazines and creating a federal database to track gun sales. Is the NRA on its last legs? And if so, will the United States, free of the NRA's toxic influence, eventually be able to end its distinction as a democracy with the highest rate of gun-related deaths and injuries? Much depends on the November elections. No two candidates for president have had as diametrically opposed views on this problem than Joe Biden and Donald Trump. In an op-ed last year, Biden wrote, quote, "I have already taken more meaningful executive action to reduce gun violence than any other president, and I will continue to pursue every legal and effective action. But my power is not absolute. Congress must act, including by banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, requiring gun owners to securely store their firearms, requiring background checks for all gun sales, and repealing gun manufacturers' immunity from liability. We also need more governors and state legislators to take these steps," end quote. At an NRA meeting this February, Trump said that no one will lay a finger on your firearms if he returns to the White House. He boasted that during his time as president, he did nothing to curb guns. "Every single Biden attack on gun owners and manufacturers will be terminated on my very first week back in office, perhaps my first day," Trump said at the NRA's presidential forum in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. If Biden is reelected and the Democrats win control of both the House and Senate, Congress must actually pass the kind of legislation that Biden has called for. In the wake of the NRA's declining influence, the time is ripe for gun control advocacy groups to expand their efforts so that the nation's public policies toward gun sales and gun ownership more accurately reflect public opinion. Our children are counting on us to stop the deadly gun violence that is destroying the nation's soul and their futures. And again, that's 25 years after the Columbine Massacre. Is There Any Hope to End America's Epidemic of Gun Violence? By Peter Dreer. Next up for News in Perspective is an opinion by Carlos Lozada. This was posted to the New York Times on April 21st, 2024, and it's called "Give Me Liberty or Give Me What?" Carlos Lozada is an opinion columnist and a co-host of the weekly Matter of Opinion podcast for The Times, based in Washington, D.C. He is the author, most recently, of The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians. If the American experiment finally decides to call it quits, how might a national breakup begin? Perhaps California moves towards secession after the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down the state's strict gun control measures. Or Texas rebels when disputes over abortion laws grow deadly and the state's National Guard remains loyal to the Second Texan Republic. Or a skirmish over the closure of a local bridge by federal inspectors escalates into a standoff between a beloved sheriff and a famous general, and the rest of the country takes sides. Or it's the coordinated bombing of state capitals timed to the 2028 presidential transition, with right-wing militias and left-wing activists blaming one another. In other words, it's not you, it's me hating you. These scenarios are not of my own creation. They all appear in recent nonfiction books warning of an American schism. The secessionist impulses take shape in David French's Divided We Fall, which cautions that Americans' political and cultural clustering risks tearing the country apart. French published it before becoming a Times columnist in 2023. The State House explosions go off in Barbara F. Walters' How Civil Wars Start, which notes that when democratic norms erode, opportunistic leaders can more easily aggravate the ethnic and cultural divides that end in violence. The Battle of the Bridge is one of several possible Sumter moments in Stephen March's The Next Civil War, which contends that our great divorce would flow from irreconcilable differences over what America stands for. These authors offer examples of what could happen, not predictions of what will. Their point is that our politics and culture are susceptible to such possibilities. The crisis has already arrived, March writes. Only the inciting incidents are pending. It is precisely the absence of inciting incidents that makes the writer-director Alex Garland's much-debated new film, Civil War, its box office success resulting in part from the multitude of newspaper columnists going to see it, such an intriguing addition to this canon. We never learn exactly who or what started the new American Civil War, or what ideologies, if any, are competing for power. It's a disorienting and risky move, but an effective one. An elaborate backstory would distract from the viewer's engagement with the war itself, the bouts of despair and detachment, of death and denial, as lived and chronicled by the weary journalists at the center of the story. Even the choice of journalists as the film's protagonists creates an additional layer of remove, especially because, weirdly, these journalists rarely discuss the origins of the conflict or question its politics, even amongst themselves. "We record so other people ask," a veteran photographer reminds her protege. The story is built around their travels from New York to Washington, where they hope to score one last presidential interview before the Capitol falls. Civil War is a road trip movie. If your trip occurs somewhere between the dislocation of Nomadland and the dystopia of The Road, if you're trying to see the national monuments before they turn to rubble, if stopping for gas involves Canadian currency and scenes of torture, if stadium camps and mass graves have become standard features of America the Beautiful. In this telling, California and Texas have both seceded and somehow allied together. They are battling the remnants of the U.S. Armed Forces, as well as some loyal Secret Service agents and diehard White House staffers, all of whom serve the same purpose as the expendable ensigns on a Star Trek landing party. There is also something called the Florida Alliance, which has been trying to persuade the Carolinas to break away from Washington, too. But the most memorable fighters in this war are the informal militias found across the country, whose motives for violence range from self-defense to self-indulgence. One fighter explains, with an annoyed air, why he's taking aim at a sniper. "Someone's trying to kill us. We are trying to kill them." Another exudes slow-motion glee while executing his uniformed, hooded prisoners. Another militant mumbles that he's strung up a local looter in part because the guy had ignored him in high school, a casual malevolence that brought to mind Shad LaDue, the murderous handyman from Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel It Can't Happen Here. Once LaDue gains a little power, just enough, over his kindly but oblivious former employers, his enduring resentment fuels his vengeance. Civil conflicts are sustained by different groups' belief that their position and status in society have been downgraded, Walter writes. Whether that erosion is real can be less relevant than the feelings of oppression and loss, and the chance to blame and punish someone for it. Once a door is opened just a crack, high school slights and condescending bosses become good excuses, precisely because they're so petty, for violence. The power of Civil War is that the snippets of context deepen the film's ambiguity as well as its realism. The president, we learn in passing, is serving a third term, and the action begins with him rehearsing his lies before addressing the nation. So, was secession a reaction to an authoritarian leader, or was his extended tenure itself a response to regional rebellion? The president made controversial decisions, like deploying airstrikes against U.S. citizens, a plot point that reminded me of the U.S. killing of the radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki in 2011, and disbanding the FBI, which evoked the fateful U.S. decision to dissolve the Iraqi military in 2003. The war photographer at the heart of the movie, played by Kirsten Dunst, gained fame in college for snapping a legendary photo of something called the Antifa Massacre. I immediately thought of the indelible Kent State photograph from 1970, also taken by a collegiate photographer, though whether this new massacre was supposedly perpetrated by or against Antifa activists is unclear. Civil War is not ripped from the headlines as much as it is stitched from history. It is not a vision of what might happen in America, but a collage of what already has happened, some here and much elsewhere. In that sense, the film is reminiscent of Omar El-Akkad's 2017 novel American War, which imagines a new civil conflict late in the 21st century after climate change has remade the country and a federal prohibition on the use of fossil fuels prompts an uprising by Americans clinging to their guns and gas guzzlers. Ella Codd, a journalist who has covered terrorism, military tribunals, and mass migration around the world, decides to put them all in one place, a future America where principle has given way to retribution. "This isn't only about secession anymore," someone explains after the fighting begins. "This is about avenging our dead." It's a book-length rebuttal of American exceptionalism. Civil War issues a similar rebuttal in a lament by Dunst's character, who struggles with flashbacks from the many conflicts she's covered, and also can't quite accept that it's happening here. "Every time I survived a war zone and got the photo," she says, "I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are." The missing backstory in Civil War does not obviate any consideration of how such a war could have begun. It forces viewers to realize that many different roads could get us there. We don't have to be the United States from the 1850s or the Balkans from the 1990s. We can choose our own misadventure. Of course, not everyone chooses sides. Political violence does not necessarily depend on mass mobilization, but on just the right mix of minority zealotry and majority indifference, or perhaps fear. In Civil War, the journalists come upon a time warp of a town, sprinklers still spraying and shops still open, seemingly insulated from the mayhem. One resident explains that she sees the war on television, but would rather just stay out. The coexistence of brutality and normality is a recurring feature of war, and I can picture many Americans getting through an actual civil war with similar distance. Maybe they'd call it self-care. But I suspect that more than enough of us would feel what Marsh calls the pleasure of contempt. That pleasure is everywhere in Civil War, no less than in the Abu Ghraib-style photo that slowly develops in the closing credits. In How Civil Wars Start, Walter points to the breakdown of a unified national identity as a precursor of strife. In Iraq, she writes, people began to ask who was Shiite and who was Sunni. In Bosnia, the distinction among Serb, Croat, and Muslim identities overpowered all else. One of the most disturbing moments in Civil War shows a camouflaged-clad fighter threatening the journalists. When they insist they are Americans, he asked, "What kind of American are you?" At gunpoint, they answer, and the fatal exchange shows that the definition of America is no longer found in the creed of liberty, equality, and opportunity, but in the sludge of blood, soil, and language. The quest for a cohesive national definition comes up in these recent books, warning of our deepening divides. Walter compares the political tensions of our time to the 1850s and the 1960s. Both times, the country's political parties had radically different visions of America's future. What could the country be? What should the country be? She hopes that America's enduring ideals and shared history can inspire us to fulfill the promise of a truly multi-ethnic democracy. In Divided We Fall, French imagines but does not expect that we might draw on our federalist tradition to let different states live as they choose while preserving individual rights, not to mention the Union. Such outcomes would require the acceptance of those shared ideals and history, a semblance of consensus around what kind of country we want to be. This is harder in an America of proliferating identities and symbols, a country where group rights and grievances risk trumping the commonalities and compromises that bind us together. Identity-based parties make it impossible for voters to switch sides, Walter writes. There is nowhere for them to go if their political identity is tied to their ethnic or religious identity. Marsh hopes that America will regain its swagger and reinvent its politics, but the estrangement he sees offers little encouragement. Each side accuses the other of hating America, he writes, which is only another way of saying that both hate what the other means by America. The debate over what kind of America we want is vital and unceasing. But when it shifts from the universal to the personal, from what kind of America we want to what kind of America we'll accept, then we have moved from conversation to interrogation, from inquiry to tragedy. You don't have to believe that a new civil war is coming to understand the dangers of the question, what kind of American are you, and to realize that the more answers we grasp for, the weaker we become. And again, that's Give Me Liberty or Give Me What by Carlos Lozada. Our next article for News in Perspective is also from the New York Times. This is an opinion by Jamel Bowie, and it's called Southern Republican Governors Are Suddenly Afraid. This was posted on April 19th, 2024. Jamel Bowie became a New York Times opinion columnist in 2019. Before that, he was the chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine. He is based in Charlottesville, Virginia, and Washington. Last year, the United Auto Workers announced an ambitious plan to organize workers and unionize foreign-owned auto plants in the South. One of our biggest goals coming out of this historic contract victory is to organize like we've never organized before, Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, said after winning significant wage and benefit gains in negotiations with Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, formerly Chrysler. When we return to the bargaining table in 2028, it won't just be with the big three, it will be the big five or six. Fain, believe it or not, may have understated the union's ambitions. The UAW is targeting 13 automakers, including Toyota, Hyundai, Honda, Nissan, Volvo, and Tesla, employing around 150,000 workers in 36 non-union plants across the South. It faced the first major test of its strategy on Wednesday, when 4,300 workers at a Volkswagen factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee, began voting on whether to unionize. The vote ends on Friday. If it's successful, it will be a breakthrough for the labor movement that has struggled to build a footing in the South. The mere potential for union success was so threatening that the day before the vote began, several of the Southern Republican governors announced their opposition to the UAW campaign. We, the governors of Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, are highly concerned about the unionization campaign driven by misinformation and scare tactics that the UAW has brought into our states, their joint statement reads. As governors, we have a responsibility to our constituents to speak up when we see special interests looking to come into our state and threaten our jobs and the values we live by. It is no shock to see conservative Republicans opposing organized labor, but it is difficult to observe this particular struggle, taking place as it is in the South, without being reminded of the region's entrenched hostility to unions, or any other institution or effort that might weaken the political and economic dominance of capital over the whole of Southern society. The history of Southern political economy is, to a great extent, a history of the unbreakable addiction of Southern political and economic elites to no-wage and low-wage labor. Before the Civil War, of course, this meant slavery. And where the peculiar institution was most lucrative, an ideology grew from the soil of the cotton and rice fields and sugar plantations, one that elevated human bondage as the only solid foundation of a stable society. In all social systems, there must be a class to do the menial duties, to perform the drudgery of life, Senator James Henry Hammond of South Carolina declared in an 1858 speech. It constitutes the very mudsill of society and of political government, and you might as well attempt to build a house in the air as to build either the one or the other, except on this mudsill. A decade later, and the slave system was dead, crushed underfoot by the armies of emancipation. The landowning Southern elites had lost their greatest asset, a seemingly inexhaustible supply of free labor. They would never regain it, but they would fight as hard as they could to approximate it. The next 30 years of Southern political life would be a roiling battle to stymie black political and economic power, part of a larger struggle to control Southern labor, black and white alike. By the turn of the 20th century, Southern elites had silenced the populist movement and the agrarian rebellion of the 1890s, which brought poor Southerners of both races together in a fledgling and fragile political alliance, with Jim Crow segregation and disenfranchisement. As the sociologist Jack M. Bloom puts it in Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement, quote, the apparent defeat of populism and the subsequent disenfranchisement of blacks brought about a severe setback for these whites as well. Many of them lost the right to vote. They were subject to the harsh terms of their employers, and they remained without labor unions to counter the power the wealthy retained. When they did try to form unions, they found the region's tradition of violence turned against them. End quote. White supremacy had triumphed, but not all whites would be supreme. Jim Crow did not eradicate black political action or erase class conflict among white people. Nonetheless, it established a hierarchical order of social and economic dominance by the owners of land and capital. It also produced a world of poverty and disinvestment, of Robert Penn Warren's torn down mills and grass-covered tracts and whitewashed shacks, all just alike, set in a row by the cotton fields. It was in defense of this world that Southern political and economic elites bitterly resisted organized labor as it grew by leaps and bounds in the 1930s, backed by Franklin Roosevelt, Robert Wagner, and the National Labor Relations Act. It was in defense of this world that those same elites fought successfully to derail the Congress of Industrial Organization's post-war effort to organize the South, Operation Dixie. It was in defense of this world, as the historian Catherine Rye Jewell points out in Dollars for Dixie, Business and the Transformation of Conservatism in the 20th Century, that Southern elites fashioned cultural traditionalism, anti-New Dealism, and free market ideology into a new mantra of free enterprise. It was meant to stand athwart a supposed movement away from individual responsibility, states' rights, and local and community self-government, in the words of the Southern States Industrial Council, a business group organized in opposition to Roosevelt's vision for the country. Organized labor was and remains a threat to the political and economic elites of a region whose foremost commitment is to the maintenance of an employer-dominated economy of low-wage labor and its attendant social order. Whereas an earlier generation complained of CIO communism, this one warns of UAW socialism. They proudly call themselves democratic socialists, the statement issued on Tuesday by the Republican governors says. You may have heard the phrase New South. It first took hold in the last decades of the 19th century, a slogan meant to distinguish the forward-looking merchants and industrialists of the post-Reconstruction years from those whose gaze was fixed hopelessly back toward a bygone age. It vaguely set apart those whose faith lay in the future from those whose heart was with the past, the historian C. Van Woodward observed. The term made a bit of a comeback in the mid-20th century to describe the modernization of the South in the years and decades after World War II. This New South was, as a result of the victories of the civil rights movement, a more moderate South of integration and economic growth. Neither the vote in Chattanooga nor the coming vote of auto workers at the Mercedes-Benz factory near Tuscaloosa, Alabama, will be dispositive for the ultimate success of the UAW campaign in the South. Win or lose, this will be a long march for organized labor. But like a gardener taking stock of her plot for the season ahead, we have to be patient. Victory might bring the chance to refresh the soil in preparation for a new kind of New South. And again, that's Southern Republican Governors Are Suddenly Afraid by Jamel Bowie. Moving along now to the Washington Post, our next article for News in Perspective is by Jason Willick. This was posted on April 21st, 2024, and it's called How the Supreme Court Could Vindicate Bill Barr on Obstruction. Jason Willick is a Washington Post columnist focusing on law, politics, and foreign policy. In 2018, as a private citizen and former attorney general, William P. Barr sent the Justice Department a 19-page memo criticizing the theory of obstruction that Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III was using to pursue Donald Trump. The memo became public after Trump nominated Barr to lead the Justice Department. Democrats and liberal commentators assailed it and defended Mueller, but in 2019, Barr was confirmed anyway and sworn in as Attorney General. The obstruction issue faded after the Mueller investigation ended with a whimper later that year. Barr resigned as Attorney General after the 2020 election over Trump's efforts to overturn it. But 6 years after his memo, in a case arising from the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot, the Supreme Court might finally vindicate Barr's legal reasoning and repudiate Mueller's. There are lessons in this saga about the law's unpredictability, and insights for the justices as they grapple with the scope of prosecutorial power in the political system. Recall, if you can, 2018. Mueller was at work probing allegations that Trump's campaign secretly colluded with Russia during the 2016 election. No charges for collusion were ever brought, but Mueller investigated at length whether Trump committed a crime by obstructing the investigation, including by asking then-FBI Director James B. Comey to go easy on Michael Flynn, who was briefly Trump's national security advisor. Barr's memo argued that Mueller's notion that Trump committed obstruction is premised on a novel and legally insupportable reading of the law. Congress had passed the 2002 law in question, 18 U.S.C. Section 1512C in legalese, after the Enron corporate fraud scandal targeting people who shredded documents to evade subpoenas. Backed by a 20-year maximum penalty, the statute prohibits corruptly altering or destroying a record, document, or other object to impair its availability for use in an official proceeding, and tacks on a prohibition against otherwise obstructing or influencing a proceeding. That statute, Barr wrote in his 2018 memo, previously had been exclusively confined to acts of evidence impairment, but he warned, correctly as it turned out, that Mueller wanted to give 1512C a new unbounded interpretation based on the otherwise clause. But he warned, correctly as it turned out, that Mueller wanted to give 1512C a new unbounded interpretation based on the otherwise clause, turning the statute into an all-encompassing provision prohibiting any act influencing a proceeding if done with an improper motive. According to Barr, that interpretation ripped the statute from its context and ignored its text and structure. It would have astounding implications for government. Now the Supreme Court will have its say. Apparently unpersuaded by Barr's reasoning, the Biden administration's Justice Department has charged some 350 out of 1,300 defendants in Capitol riot cases with violating 1512C by disrupting the joint session of Congress. One defendant challenged the statute's application to him in Fisher v. United States, which reached the Supreme Court for oral arguments on Tuesday. Solicitor General Elizabeth B. Preligar, who worked on the Mueller probe, argued that 1512C swept far beyond evidence tampering. Any efforts to obstruct a current or future proceeding could potentially be covered, including, she conceded, nonviolent acts of protest. A majority of the justices, including President Biden's appointee, Ketanji Brown Jackson, seemed skeptical that the law could apply to conduct so different from the type it was drafted to prohibit in the wake of Enron. Preligar assured the justices that the statute's corruptly requirement would prevent it from being overused, but Barr's memo warned that courts have evinced a lot of confusion over that term. Under Mueller's theory, Barr worried, controversial acts Trump took as president aimed at influencing the Justice Department could become felonies if Mueller judged that Trump had nefarious intent. That would be a subjective political conclusion. Historically, Barr argued, corrupt obstruction of a proceeding meant something more concrete, compromise the honesty of a decision-maker or impairing evidence. Barr's observations also foreshadowed the problems of presidential immunity that the Supreme Court will consider this week. Trump's lawyers will argue Thursday that he cannot be criminally prosecuted for official acts he took as president under the logic of a 1982 Supreme Court decision that barred civil lawsuits against a president for official acts. The government, represented again by a Mueller probe veteran, Michael Dreeben, will argue that there is no such immunity. Trump has not argued and could not plausibly argue that the Constitution vests the president with authority to perform the conduct prohibited by the obstruction law, Dreeben's brief says. But Barr saw in 2018 that this was not true. The once and future attorney general was deeply concerned that an overbroad definition of obstruction would infringe on the president's constitutional duties. After all, a big part of a president's job is to make decisions influencing proceedings, he observed. An untold number of proceedings take place simultaneously in the executive branch departments and agencies the president oversees, and the president also often tries to influence Congress. If that influence can by itself be a crime based on a subjective judgment of the president's state of mind, it would seem to suggest a need for presidential immunity for the government to function. Barr's preferred solution for this constitutional problem was simply to rein in prosecutors' implausible definition of obstruction under 1512C. As Barr explained, if a president knowingly destroys or alters evidence, suborns perjury, or induces a witness to change testimony, then he, like anyone else, commits the crime of obstruction. Under a correct reading of the obstruction law, it would in no way infringe on a president's constitutional powers, Barr wrote. One problem for the Biden administration is that it is asking the justices to bless a sweeping interpretation of 1512C at the same time it tells them there is no need for presidential immunity. It's hard to see how both of those positions could prevail. Barr's memo helps illustrate a subtle link between the Fisher obstruction case and the presidential immunity case. The more extravagantly prosecutors construe criminal laws, such as 1512C, the greater the need for presidential immunity to prevent bullheaded prosecutors from disabling the presidency. But if the Supreme Court continues to rein in prosecutors' novel legal theories, as it likely will do in Fisher, then the president's prerogatives are less likely to be criminalized in the first place, and the need for immunity is diminished. A poorly drafted obstruction law is playing an alarmingly prominent role in American politics. It helped power the Mueller investigation that dominated Trump's first 2 years in office, polarized the country, and radicalized many conservatives against the deep state without producing any collusion charges. It was then put to novel use in response to a violent riot that interrupted the transfer of power and shamed the country. Those two episodes bookend Barr's experience as a Trump official. If the Supreme Court affirms his 2018 analysis in June, as it should, it will be vindication of the tragic kind. And again, that's How the Supreme Court Could Vindicate Bill Barr on Obstruction by Jason Willick. Next up for today's News in Perspective is an opinion piece from the Richmond Times-Dispatch. This was written by Michael Paul Williams and posted on April 20th, 2024. It's called How Do You Define Hypocrisy? Ask Hanover, which just censored a Girl Scout. After the Hanover County School Board banned 19 books last June, Kate Lindley launched Free to Read, her Girl Scout Gold Award project. Lindley, who'd competed as a reading Olympian as a Hanover student, was appalled at the censorship and determined to combat it. She coded a Free to Read app with information about the misbegotten ban and the books affected. And after the board banned more than 70 additional books in November, she set up banned book nooks at two Hanover businesses, Moore Donuts in Mechanicsville and We Think in Ink in Ashland. At its April 10th meeting, the Hanover Board of Supervisors honored Lindley and several other Girl Scouts from Troop 789 in Hanover who'd earned their gold awards, the highest award granted by Girl Scouts of the USA. But like their counterparts on the county school board, the Board of Supervisors could not resist the temptation to censor. Cold Harbor Supervisor Michael Herzberg stripped Lindley's proclamation of its context by removing mention of the school board book bans that spurred her to action in the first place. And then, save absent Ashland Supervisor Faye Pritchard, it unanimously approved the redacted document, effectively distorting the story behind it. In support of a school board ban of literary classics such as Slaughterhouse-Five and The Handmaid's Tale, among other titles, the supervisors censored a Girl Scout. You can't make this up. Honestly, at first, I just started laughing, recalled Lindley, a senior at Maggie L. Walker Governor's School, who's headed to Georgia Tech to study computer science. It's kind of hilarious. For me, it's very ironic that they decided to censor my project that's meant to fight censorship. Asked in an email why he edited Lindley's proclamation, Herzberg replied, "Board proclamations are issued with a vote by the board. Some books that contain porn and sexually explicit content were deselected from Hanover Public Schools, and I support that action. Books with porn and sexually explicit content do not have my support for a board proclamation." Other young people are smarter than these politicians think. They can smell the stench of rank hypocrisy a country mile away. They aren't fooled by folks spouting platitudes about the Constitution while supporting politicians who forswear their oath to the document as they toss lit matchsticks at the First Amendment. They can distinguish a political exercise from an educational one. Their motivations don't seem to me in any way to be noble or for the actual protection of students, Lindley said. For technology-savvy high school students on the cusp of adulthood, censoring reading material is a pointless waste of time. In Virginia, it could be worse. We could be like Missouri or other states that have criminalized those who don't go along with this censorship agenda. A suburban St. Louis library removed an illustrated edition of the Margaret Atwood classic The Handmaid's Tale after Missouri passed a law subjecting librarians to fines and possible imprisonment for allowing sexually explicit materials on bookshelves, according to the Associated Press. The laws are designed to limit or remove legal protections that libraries have had for decades, Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, says in the story. When you start locking up the librarians, it's only a matter of time before the mob starts making a bonfire out of thousands of books as a prelude of the horrors to come. Speaking of incarceration, it should come as no surprise that more books are banned in prisons than in schools and libraries combined. That was among the findings of Wanda Felschenhart, a graduate student at Virginia Commonwealth University's Brand Center, as she completed her award-winning entry in the Jurgen Comics Contest by VCU Libraries. The contest is named for James Branch Cabell's 1919 book, Jurgen, A Comedy of Justice, the object of an ultimately unsuccessful obscenity lawsuit by the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. It focuses on telling stories of banned art as a way to consider the complex relationship between art and society and the long history of censorship. According to Felsenhart's comic, among the banned books are Prison Ramen, Recipes and Stories from Behind Bars, Dungeons and Dragons Manuals, and In Florida, which leads the nation in prison book banning, Klingon Dictionaries. Klingons are a fictional race from the Star Trek series. People, no matter where they are, should have that connection to the outside world and have the ability to learn and better themselves through reading. I think reading is so fundamentally important, Felsenhart said. Of course, there are documented links between low literacy and incarceration, but just as school boards cite protecting the kids to justify censorship, prisons point at security as a reason for censorship, even as prison libraries aid rehabilitation efforts. I don't think reading a book is inherently violent or dangerous ever, so just the fact that people want to ban things, any type of reading, is crazy to me, Felsenhart said. Even being able to read things you disagree with is important just to become more well-rounded and have more empathy toward people who aren't like you. In prison, not unlike in our public school districts and libraries, black authors are often targeted. Topics such as civil rights, injustice, or prison reform are red-flagged. Felsenhart's comic quotes James Baldwin saying, "The victim who is able to articulate the situation of the victim has ceased to be a victim. He or she has become a threat." Apparently, Lindley represents a threat in Hanover. I am honored that they think that my project is enough of a disruption that they feel the need to censor it in any way, she said. That is an honor to me and the work I've done personally, but still, maybe not the best choice they could have made. Lindley plans to speak at Wednesday's Board of Supervisors meeting so that the audience can understand and appreciate my project for what it was and what it continues to be. That's assuming the board allows her to speak freely. And again, that's How Do You Define Hypocrisy? Ask Hanover, which just censored a Girl Scout by Michael Paul Williams. And finally today, our last article for News in Perspective is from the Washington Post. This is by E.J. Dion Jr., and was posted on April 21st, 2024. It's called, Do Republicans Really Care About Democracy as Much as Democrats? No. Take a look at polling data, and you might get the impression that there is a glorious bipartisan consensus that our democracy is in trouble and needs nurturing. In reality, there are profoundly dissonant chords in the democracy chorus. Start with the seemingly good news. A New York Times Siena poll from fall 2022, for example, found that 71% of Americans agreed that democracy is currently under threat. there was hardly a wisp of a difference across party lines. 74% of Democrats agreed, but so did 72% of Republicans and 71% of Independents. Kumbaya, my lord. Such data has encouraged conservatives to dismiss the effort of Democrats, starting with President Biden, to insist that in the 2024 election, democracy is on the ballot. The Wall Street Journal's Holman W. Jenkins Jr., for instance, recently referenced a February NBC News poll showing Biden and Donald Trump essentially tied on the issue of who would best protect democracy. 43% of voters preferred Biden, 41% picked the former president. He concluded, "Pollsters find Trump voters every bit as concerned about democracy as Biden voters." If only that were true. In reality, only on one side of politics is democracy a voting issue, and the other would render our system less democratic by making it harder for voters to cast ballots. That Times Siena poll was instructive here. It asked voters what concerned them more about elections, that some people will cast votes illegally or that some eligible voters won't have a fair chance to vote. The country split right down the middle, 46% worried about illegal voting, 48% about voter suppression. That's because partisans were entirely at odds. 82% of Republicans were more concerned about voters casting illegal ballots, while 76% of Democrats were more concerned about voters not getting a fair chance to vote. This divide has led to radically different voting policies, state by state, depending on which party holds sway. The Post's Patrick Marley reported that in Michigan, controlled by Democrats, voting will be easier in 2024 than it was in 2020. Whereas North Carolina, where Republicans hold a veto-proof legislative majority, has erected new barriers to the ballot box. And during his recent pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago to earn kudos from Trump, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, pitched a federal bill to require proof of citizenship from those who would register to vote. Since Trump believes that any election he loses must have been rigged, Johnson's effort must have warmed the former president's heart. This is not some honest disagreement about whether voting should be easier or harder. New barriers to voting and voter purges are being rationalized to solve problems that don't exist because there is no evidence, zip, that fraud is a problem in our system. Non-citizen voting in federal and state elections is already illegal everywhere, and studies by the Brennan Center for Justice concluded that votes by non-citizens account for between 0.0003% and 0.001% of all votes cast. A separate Brennan Center report estimated incident rates for overall voter fraud between 0.0003% and 0.0025%. When someone offers policy changes based on claims devoid of any factual support, it's fair to suspect that something other than solving a real problem is motivating their proposals. On this, the Times Siena poll provided an important clue. It found that while 95% of Democrats said Biden was the legitimate winner in 2020, only 31% of Republicans said this. Their objection is to the outcome, not the process. Bear in mind that the voting changes introduced to make it easier to vote during the pandemic, simpler early and mail voting, widely available ballot drop boxes, and the like, produced by far the largest numerical turnout in our history. Holding a successful election in a health crisis was a great victory for democracy, and by the way, the emergency reforms helped Trump get 11.2 million more votes in 2020 than he got in 2016. Yet Republicans seem eager to roll back participation. The acid test of whether both sides are equally concerned about an issue is the degree to which it motivates their respective electoral coalitions. And here, the data is unambiguous. Democracy is a core concern for Democrats in a way it is not for Republicans. It's not even close. In a March Quinnipiac poll, voters who listed preserving democracy as the most urgent issue facing the country favored Biden over Trump in a head-to-head mashup by 85% to 12%. That's because 32% of Democrats listed preserving democracy as the campaign's most important issue. Only 5% of Republicans did. I wish Biden were wrong in saying democracy is on the ballot this year. Unfortunately, he's not. And that's all the time we have for today's News in Perspective. I'm Brian Kim for the Virginia Voice. This program is on the air daily at 3 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. You can also listen anytime on demand at www.virginiavoice. Thanks for listening.